Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're all very welcome back to the Celtic Soul Podcast with me, Andrew Millen. My guest on the show today will be Celtic historian and author David Potter. This episode has been sponsored by The Tunnel Craftworks, Portadown, and I would like to thank Tip McCann for his continued support of both the fanzine and now the podcast. If your business or Celtic Supporters Club would like to give us some support or sponsor an episode, please email us at info@celticfanzine.com. You can also contact us through the website or on our social media platforms. 10 years of group stage football in Europe was what we were reminded of when the reporter told Neil Lennon last night after he watched Sarajevo park the bus at home in a one-off tie. Celtic did come up with the goods and produced another winning performance, this time French Eddie producing the goods in front of goal. Celtic were dominant throughout the game, and now we all look towards St Johnstone away on Sunday and a crucial 3 points up for grabs. Let's not look too far ahead to the Rangers game. This game is every bit as important in the quest for 10, and the same amount of points are up for grabs. The only thing that's up for grabs when we play Rangers, apart from 3 points, is bragging rights. And bragging rights don't win titles. 10 years of waiting for the draw, hoping to get online quick enough to get a cheap flight or a hotel in the Europa League or the Champions League. How we would have loved to be doing that today when the draw was made earlier. UEFA have given the go-ahead for 30% of fans to re-enter football stadiums, if the government of that country allows. We have seen fans return to football in Germany, but in my home country, Ireland, and indeed in Scotland, restrictions are getting tighter as the coronavirus continues to spread. So I can't see us getting into Celtic Park anytime soon, but I really hope I'm wrong. David Potter is a retired school teacher who hails from Forfar in Scotland. He is a respected Celtic historian and has wrote numerous books on the club. He has contributed more than 90 minutes for many years and is also a regular contributor on our website, CelticFanzine.com. Hi David, you're very welcome to the Celtic Soul Podcast. Did you ever think that we would be living under such restrictions, and how have you spent the time in lockdown, cocooning, and not been able to go to see Celtic?
Well, it's been a problem. Obviously, nobody could have predicted what's happened to the world the last 6 months or so. Nevertheless, I think it's something we just have to get through. I think we will get through it. I think that one of the great comforts is actually the knowledge of Celtic, you know, the sort of thing that's kept us going for all these years. I mean, for example, at the start of lockdown, I wrote a book. My publisher wanted me to do this, to write a book on Celtic in the Scottish Cup. You know, it's the Scottish Cup, Celtic's favourite trophy, which will be published in November. And that's been a great help to me. I've obviously done in a hurry, but my publisher was quite keen that it should be done in lockdown because he thinks there's all the more need for people. People do actually read books a lot more in lockdown. Books have not been affected by the general economic collapse. They're one of the things they're doing very well.
Yeah, it's funny when you mention the books. I think when we went into lockdown first, readership on the website went through the roof. And then out of that, we started the podcast just to keep busy, really. And that's gone now. Though that's gone. We can't believe it. Well, that's gone. So yeah, there definitely is. And until the season started up again, people were delving into the history because we couldn't look forward at that stage. We were delving into the history. So I'm sure a lot of your books got read. Now, just before we get stuck into talking about Celtic, how many books have you written in total, and how many of them are about Celtic?
I think it's difficult to say because I've done a lot as in conjunction with other people. Probably I've done about, 40 books, and about 30 of them will be about Celtic.
Wow.
My speciality is actually biographies of old Celtic players. For example, at the moment, I'm now working on one about Alec McNair. You know, from Stennis Muir, the right back of the great team of Melee's Edwardian 11. And I've just started working on him, and he's a fascinating character as well.
And how do you say, obviously, you've done some books with players who are still living, so it's easy to research them, or the families are still living. How hard is it to research a book about one of these players from yesteryear?
Well, actually, to be honest, I frankly prefer doing books about yesteryear, because if you do things about current players or recently dead players, you have a great chance of saying the wrong thing, of upsetting people, which is not really what I'm in the interest of, I really want to do. You know, I'd far rather write about somebody like Alec McNair or McMenemy or Sonny Jim or somebody like that, somebody who is who's long dead, because you're less likely to upset anybody. And also there's a certain degree of objectivity about it, because you're based on looking for newspapers and whatnot. Whereas if you go by people's recollections of an event, they're very much skewed in one direction or another. And quite a lot of players I've discovered actually get things wrong about their own life. You know, they claim they played in the game when in fact they didn't.
So you need the facts to be correct. And I suppose are you delving through libraries and books and newspapers?
Yes. Basically, the British Newspaper Archive has been a great tool for me, because that has most newspapers of the era in which I'm interested. And they're very good. And you have to work hard to find it. I mean, it's a lot of hard work finding these things. But especially in lockdown, it means I don't actually have to go to libraries. Obviously, it's a lot better if you could go to libraries and spend a whole afternoon there, which is clearly not possible these days. But it's a lot easier just by looking up on your computer. And it's remarkable what you find on your computer. Remarkable.
Sure is. I read the Sonny Jim book again recently. It wasn't actually, it was before the lockdown. And it's testimony to you that you are educating us and bringing these people to life in these books, because a lot of people, they go back as far as maybe 57 and the 7-1, and you know, because people are still alive and they can still talk about it, and then they push forward to the Great Lisbon Lions and so forth. So for me, it's great to delve in, and I think the readers of the fanzine are lucky as well, because you've always contributed and given us, there's always something we don't know when you send an article in. And we always get a great response from the readers.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
But I'm going to push forward now many, many years. I'm going to push forward to last night. Another qualification for a European group, not the Champions League. I noticed last night that Neil was more relieved that we qualified. Yeah. I then switched over to watch Dundalk, and they were celebrating like they had won the Europa League, because it's a massive thing for an Irish club to qualify for the group stages. And then I finally finished off my football viewing, watching the end of the Rangers game. And they celebrated like they had won it. So it seems to be a bigger thing across the city than it does be for to Celtic and maybe the Celtic fans. Do you think we've been spoiled for the past 10 years?
I think we probably have. We've also been deprived in a way as well, because we feel that we really should be in the Champions League and doing well in the Champions League, because our support is big enough to warrant that. You know, the support and enthusiasm for the club worldwide is, in my view, actually second to none. And we really feel, therefore, that we should be in the Champions League and performing well in the Champions League. Having said that, getting to the Europa League is at least something. My main emotion last night was relief. I was very glad to hear the referee's final whistle. I mean, I know we played very well, actually, to be in some ways, and we should have scored more goals, but there's still that feeling that Celtic tend to give away silly goals at the back. Now, that has actually stopped to a certain extent the past recently. But in the time of when Roy Aiken and Tom McAdam and that played in the defence, you could always guarantee that Celtic would throw away a silly goal in Europe. You know, and you're always that at the back of your mind. And Europe has always been a great disappointment to me in recent years. I mean, that, of course, is because I remember Lisbon.
Yeah, I think of all our listeners that are kind of spoiled. And I think a lot of our younger listeners are spoiled, and the younger fans, because they don't know defeat. You were lucky enough to remember the highs when Celtic were conquering Europe. But someone like me who's in between, I thought it was great when I started following Celtic. Just when I got an interest in them, they'd done a centenary double. They won the cup the following year. And then I had 10 barren years with the exception of the Scottish Cup. So,
I
think maybe some are spoiled, some were spoiled, and some of us really are enjoying this because we went through those barren years, as I said. Now, also, we have a game on Saturday against St. Johnstone, or Sunday against St. Johnstone. And I think listening to fans last night and listening to a couple of podcasts this morning, I think we're overlooking this game. You know, these are games we can slip up, and we have slipped up after European games before. I think people are looking too far ahead. There's an international break before we play Rangers. So it's very important. And you know more than anybody that upsets happen because you know the history books.
Well, certainly. I think that St. Johnstone is a ground which you always get a tough game there, but we tend to pull through at St. Johnstone in recent years, certainly. It wasn't always like this. I've seen them being beaten at St. Johnstone in the past several times. But I think that it's a ground that actually I like going to, both at their old Muirton Park and now their McDermott Park, because they're a team which is not really from a footballing part of Scotland. But yeah, they do very well to keep keep their team going, you know. And I've always liked St. Johnstone supporters. I know they're one of the few supporters of football teams that actually vote Conservative in Scotland, apparently. Them and Rangers and Queen of the South apparently are all tend to vote Conservatives, but they're all quite decent people, you know. They're kind of like Dunfermline. Dunfermline's a team that I've always liked their supporters. You know, there's nothing really nasty about Dunfermline, or indeed most supporters of most teams are actually quite decent. There are the exceptions, of course. But to get back to your point about St. Johnstone, yes, we mustn't take them too lightly, because the way this league is going this year, it is going to be very, very tight, because we can't really afford any slip-ups at all, because Rangers, let's face it, are really quite good this year. They're far better than they've been for many years, in my view.
Yeah, they're not conceding many goals either.
No, they're not. No, they're not.
For the listeners, that's Ali in the background, David's dog.
That's my dog, yes.
So welcome to the podcast, Ali.
He's actually in the back door, believe it or not, but it's a nice day. He's running about daft at the back door. Yeah.
Oh, he can't be the man's best friend. David, can you take the listeners back to your early days of supporting Celtic? And I know your dad was an influence on you. Can you just take us back maybe through the early days?
Well, I first saw Celtic at Dens Park in 1958. I was just too young to have gone to see the 7-1 game. I remember all about the 7-1 game. I remember who was doing that afternoon. It was at the matinee performance of the pictures, and I remember coming home and all that. I was just a bit too young for the 7-1 game. And the context of Lisbon and the success of the late 60s was actually late in the early 60s. The early 60s were my formative years, and really it was a dreadful time to be supporting Celtic, because they had good enough players, they had, in theory, a good manager, but the manager wasn't allowed to run the team. The team was run by the Bob Kelly, who, frankly, for all that he did for Celtic in the political sense, he really didn't know very much about football. He wasn't actually a football man. I take my hat off to him for his fight to keep the ERA flag flying over Celtic Park in 1952, and he made sure that Celtic weren't ever bullied. I mean, he was well into the SFA and the Scottish League and things like that, so he did a good job in that respect, but frankly, he just didn't know very much about football. And Mr. McGrory was a nice gentleman, but rather easily persuaded that this guy should be inside right and this guy should be inside left. And the result was really a very frustrating and a very angry and a very heartbreaking time to be a young man at the fall of Celtic. I mean, I remember vividly the Scottish Cup final replays on Wednesday nights of Dunfermline 61, Rangers in 63. I mean, these were just awful nights, you know, awful to go through. And never any sort of thing you could say against Rangers supporters to shut them up other than 7-1, which the oftener he talked about 7-1, the less effect it had on them, because it was, you know, got more and more into the history, and we just really had nothing to speak about until Mr. Steen arrived. Mr. Steen's arrival was more or less instant change. My favourite game probably is still the Celtic Dunfermline Scottish Cup final of 1965, Billy McNeil's header, and probably it beats Lisbon. I was actually at Hampden that day. I wasn't at Lisbon, I was a student, I couldn't afford it, but I certainly was at Hampden in 1965, and it's probably still is my favourite Celtic game in it. It changed everything. I mean, the word revolution comes to mind. I mean, you have to be very careful about the word revolution if you talk about the French and the Russian revolutions and so on. But certainly, this game against Dunfermline, 24th of April 1965, was indeed a revolution.
So would you compare the 65 Cup final maybe to, in modern day, to the 6-2 against Rangers when Martin O'Neill, we knew that things were changing?
Yes, the cry was no defenders game. Yes, I love that game as well. I would actually compare it more... the parallel in, if I may say so, in your time, was probably the Airdrie Cup final of 1995. Now, that was a terrible game. It was really one of the worst Celtic teams of all time, actually. They really didn't deserve to win very much in these days, because the players they had were just, frankly, substandard in some cases. But they won well that day. Didn't win well that day. They won that day. And the feeling I remember of the support, I wasn't at that game, couldn't get a ticket. As you remember, there was only 37,000 allowed in Hampden in 1995. And the feeling of the support, they were just energised and so on. And actually, the next 2 years, Celtic played well. In 1996, 1997, they were a good team in both these years. Just that Rangers had the luck on the right occasions and Rangers got the better of them. But I would certainly say the parallel, looking back on it historically, yes, the 6-2 game, that was the one that really changed things. You know, and appropriately, it was at the start of the new century as well. 27th of August 2000, if I remember rightly, was it? Am I right? And that really changed things. And that showed everybody that Celtic now, with a new stadium and energised support, that they really did mean business. And of course, they did.
And push on, they did. And we've enjoyed it ever since. I know we've had a couple of managers and we've had many players, but the fans are always there, and I think we have, you know, we've had some great times. Who would have believed that we would have got to a final in Europe when we were knocked out by Bale in the Champions League qualifier, and then we went on this amazing run to Seville, which probably a season we won nothing, but a season that sticks out in my mind as one of my favourite seasons following Celtic.
Yes, 2003. Actually, I frankly think that the best football was played, though, in season 2002. If you remember, we won the league by a country mile that day, beating, I think, Livingston to win it, with the games in hand. But the football was really superb that year. Again, unfortunately, we lost in two unfortunate games to Rangers and also in Europe as well. But I really enjoyed that particular year, 2001 to 2002. I know we didn't win as much as we should have won or as we deserved to have won in that year, but I thought the football was really quite superb. And indeed, 2003 as well. It was also loads of good football. And of course, you had the man whom you've named your dog after, Henrik Larsson. You know, he wasn't a bad player.
Yeah, I remember you picked a best 11 of players who we wouldn't have known for the fans. Yes. And you picked it a couple of years ago because at that time we had the opportunity to vote for the greatest ever Celtic team, and arguably they all deserve a merit. But I did pose the question to you, and you go back and we must dig it out, actually, that article, and you went back and you spoke about all these great players we had over the years. But I think Henrik fits into any team.
Oh, yes, indeed, yes.
He's the greatest I've seen at Celtic, and him and Paul McStay, I think, are two standout players from many, many brilliant players we've seen.
I was just going to say about Paul McStay, I'm actually quite sorry for Paul McStay, because he was a brilliant player who came at a bad time. You know, I think I'm a wee bit sorry for Paul. He was as good as you could expect, you know. He was very good, very good, but he just came at the wrong time. And he didn't quite have the, you know, how can I put it? He didn't quite have the personality to lift the team on his own, you know, in the way that maybe Larson did, because Larson scored goals. I mean, McStay could score goals as well. McStay had visionary passing ability, but there was just too much going wrong for Paul at that time at Celtic Park. You know, with players who perhaps were, you know, good enough, but not brilliant. You know, not in the same class as Paul.
Well, without doubt, yeah, Paul was outstanding, and I had Willie on the podcast recently, and yeah. You know, he says Paul deserves everything. Every plaudit that he gets, because he was magnificent. And he was so loyal to Celtic, and I don't think we'd see that in the modern footballer.
No,
I don't think Peter Lowell would allow it. He would definitely sell him on.
Aye, well, and I also think quite a lot of modern players who had, you know, with any sort of ability would say, here, we're no sticking around for this. You know, given the chaos that was going on in the early 90s. You know, I mentioned the early 60s and the early 90s. These were the bad years. They have one thing in common. And the thing in common is the name Kelly, I'm afraid.
Yeah, true,
the Kellys, yeah. In his day, I'm afraid, have a lot to answer for. James Kelly in the early days was good. A great player, great administrator, but the Kellys of the 1960s and the 1990s, I'm afraid, I really don't have very much sympathy for.
I don't know how I follow that, because I think a lot of people think the same. We've been lucky enough to have people on that were involved in overthrowing the Kellys, and we've had people on who... John Fallon was on, and I know when he received his medal, there was some unsavoury comments on Twitter from members of families who were ousted at Celtic Park.
I have heard the story about John's medal, incidentally, and I've heard it from John himself, and he's put it very graphically to me. Let's just leave it like that.
Yes, and John is not a man that minces his words, as you know.
John does not hold back. John's a great Celt. I love John.
And you wrote his book, so...
Indeed, yes.
You know more about John than probably he does himself sometimes.
Well, John was actually very, very communicative. I mean, when he wrote his book, I mean, you had the job shutting him up sometimes, you know, because he said a few things that, you know, I had to exclude because they were just a wee bit too, you know, well, they weren't really relevant in some cases, you know, and a total difference from the book that I wrote about Charlie Gallagher. Now, Charlie's a different guy altogether. Charlie found it very difficult to get Charlie to say anything about himself. And Charlie was a great player, you know, but it's all about, you know, writing about players that are still alive. You just have to watch what you're doing sometimes, you know, which is why I prefer the old ones.
I always write when I interviewed Charlie. I interviewed him at a dinner dance for the magazine. Many years ago, up in Ballymena, and he actually cried during the interview. Charlie did. It was a brilliant interview, and as you say, it's hard to get him to talk. I've attended many functions, and he won't speak at them. But he was the interview was brilliant, and it's still to this day, it's one of the best interviews I ever done.
One that
sticks out, because he spoke about when he represented Ireland, the first non-Irish born player. You know, yes, represented the Diaspora, and Jimmy McGee, the great Jimmy McGee, the commentator, had gone to Donegal and was in his family's home, and they had him on the radio, and it was like, when you think back to the 60s, you know, that must have been the big thing to, you know, for him to travel to Donegal to capture this moment. And unfortunately, Charlie only played a handful of times for the Republic, because back then, I think, if there was trouble with chairman in Celtic, I think the players maybe were picking the teams for Ireland. Anyway, Dave, now, Celtic is a club for all. It's a club for all religions and none. You come from the Protestant faith, and football fans of all faiths follow Celtic. But normally when someone comes from the Protestant faith and they're not Glasgow born, they tend to lean towards Rangers.
Oh, I think I can explain that very, very readily. Actually, very readily. It all goes back to my grandfather. Actually, my great grandfather, to a certain extent, but mainly my grandfather, who was he played for a junior football team called Forfar Celtic, around about the turn of the century, the 18th to 19th century, and he began to love the Glasgow Celtic because they played so well. I mean, he was a fairly young man when young Looney and he and Jimmy Quinn and them were around, and he was able to go and see them once or twice, and he was just attracted by the sheer quality of the football And it was no for no other reason at all. And there are quite a lot of people in the east of Scotland. I know the west of Scotland, particularly around with Glasgow, can be different. But the east of Scotland, I would honestly say that sectarianism, it's not to say it doesn't exist, but it's absolutely minimal and usually ridiculed by people like me. I mean, I will never talk about sectarianism without ridiculing it. And I mean, I'll stick with that, you know. And I mean, I think you have to be very aware that it is an issue, but it's really quite poisonous, you know. And one of my favourite hobbies now and again is drawing up a team of all time, you know, of Protestants versus Catholics, you know, if we've played for Celtic, you know. And I think I would have to say I think probably the Catholics would win because you've got Patsy Gallagher and Jimmy McMenemy and Jimmy McGrory. The Catholics would probably win. But on the other hand, the Protestants would put up a good performance with Jock Stein as their manager, John Thompson in the goal, Sonny Jim at right half, Henrik Larsson in the forward line, Kenny Dalglish in the forward line. I mean, wouldn't it be a bad team at all?
You might stick Danny McGrain in there as well.
Oh, Danny, I forgot about Danny McGrain. My apologies, Danny. Danny would write back. Yes, indeed. Or actually, the one I'm reading at the moment, Alec McNair, the one I'm researching at the moment, Alec McNair, was also from a non-Catholic background. So I probably do think the Roman Catholics would win just because of Patsy Gallagher and people. But it doesn't matter.
That's why I said a team for all.
A team for all. And here the Protestants would also have Bertie Auld, you know. Now he would be, can imagine him doing a few crafty wee, you know, ones on Patsy Gallagher and things. It would be fun. It'd be fun.
Yes, I love the way Amoyam walks. It's brilliant. You got me thinking though.
Tommy Gemmell at left back as well. Tommy Gemmell would be a good left back.
Yes, yeah, you're getting a great team there.
And indeed, then. And John Thompson in the goal, I mean, come on. Or even keeping it Ronnie Simpson. Ronnie Simpson would be the substitute goalkeeper, you know?
Yeah, I think that's the great thing about Celtic, that we've had so many players from different faiths and different colours and different religions over the years. And we can be proud of that.
Of course. Yeah.
Now, listen, I can't have you on the podcast without you taking me back to that famous night in Lisbon in 1967 when you were a student in Glasgow. Because I apologize. I've heard this story before, so I'd love you to share it with the listeners.
Well, what is there to say? I mean, we went 2-1. My own particular memory, of course, is that it was the reason I didn't go was I probably could have afforded it. I think my father would have found ways of getting money to get me to go to Lisbon if I wanted to. But unfortunately, I had my Greek exam the next day, first year Greek. So I was sitting in our common room all afternoon, bagging a seat to see the game. And I was reading Homer's Iliad 1 and Homer's Iliad 8 and Euripides' Dia. And I remember, I was kind of worried about my Greek as well, you know, but I did pass as it turned out. And so 5:30 came, on comes the television, and the bloody thing broke down, as happened a lot in the 1960s, you know, just at the time when Inter Milan got the penalty. I didn't see the penalty, so my friend and I, who was actually a Rangers supporter, but was supporting Celtic tonight, we ran up to the next residence hall up the top of the road, and we watched the rest of the game there. And everything just passed so quickly and so euphorically, and you really couldn't take it in at the time. You know, there was so many great things that were going on, and you didn't realise the enormity of it all until probably even years later. You didn't realise what it meant to have won the European Cup, you know, and obviously it's a great part of my life still.
And when did you get to speak to your dad? Because obviously you were at college to celebrate.
Yes. That's where my dad actually had phoned when I was out celebrating. And then I think he phoned the next day, if I remember rightly, but he was still totally incoherent, you know. And of course, I went, my exam was on the Friday, and on the Saturday morning, believe it or not, this Andrews University gave you exams on Saturday morning, but I went home on the Saturday afternoon on the bus with my cases and everything. And the first thing my dad said to me was, well, that was a great win on. A great win on Thursday night, and we talked about nothing else for the rest of that summer. You know, it was just quite unbelievable the way that they things had happened. I just wish we get a chance to see this happening again. I really do.
Yeah, when we think back to like 67, you look at the big, you know, the team arriving back to Glasgow on the back of a coal lorry, looking so dapper, you know, looking like mods from a scooter rally, looking so well in the the short hair, the tin toys, the suits, they look so sharp. Can you remember what else was going on around that time in the world or in Scotland? Or?
Yes, very, very, very clearly, because at moments like that, you're related to other things. Obviously, I had my own business about getting through my exams at the end of my first year at St Andrews and having finished my first year and so on. But I do remember also the Arab-Israeli war broke out on, I think, the 5th of June. I may be wrong about that, but very soon afterwards, and they were all, muscling up to each other in the Middle East. And I didn't really understand the Middle East politics in these days. I didn't understand really what it was all about. I didn't actually see what the fuss was all about. But I remember everybody saying, oh, this could lead to a nuclear war and things like this. And there was still a wee bit in Great Britain of mistrust against Nasser, who was, of course, the dictator of Egypt, who'd fallen out with Anthony Eden over Suez in 1956. This was only 11 years later, and there was still a lot of feelings of, oh, you've got to watch that Nasser. You've got to watch him. He's a badin, you know? People went around saying that, you know, without really understanding very much about what the Middle East situation was all about. But I remember that was going on, you know, immediately after the European time. And of course, on the Wednesday afterwards, there was Rangers in their European Cup Winners' Cup. Now, for a long time, I really agonised about that game, because had Rangers won that game, it would have been without any doubt, Scotland would have been the footballing capital of the world. I mean, I could imagine that both trophies would have been on show in Edinburgh Castle and Stirling Castle and all these places, you know, and everybody would have flocked to Scotland to see. So there would have been spin-offs that way. On the other hand, I found it very, very difficult. In fact, I found it impossible to want Rangers to win anything. I had a lot of friends who were Rangers supporters, and I really was actually, in some ways, I was quite sorry for them, because they actually, quite a lot of my friends were actually sorry for me in the early 60s. I would have to say that. They were, you know, and I was quite sorry for what they'd gone through in 1967 at Berwick. And I remember on the Wednesday night watching the game on TV, and my father made a point of digging his garden that night. Now, my father had always said that if Rangers were playing at the back door, he would draw the curtains so as not to see them. Now, he carried out his what he said about that. It was the other way around. Rangers were playing in the house, so he went outside and he was digging his garden, you know. And I came, went out, wandered about half-time to tell him how the game was going, and he pretended not to be interested. And then, of course, eventually the Germans scored in extra time and Germans won. They went out. By this time, it was getting a wee bit dark, you know. And my dad was still working away his garden. I says, aye, that's Bayern Munich have won. They scored an extra time and they've beaten Rangers, you know. And he stopped what he was doing. He looked at me and he said something like, how sad for them. And I says, aye, how sad. And then the pair of us were caught each other's eyes and we doubled up with laughter. And my mind went back to 4 years previously, that horrible night of the 1963 Scottish Cup final, when the Celtic end emptied. You know, I remember the glow of blue colours at the other end. I remember the almost eerie silence at the Celtic end as people started to go home, you know, and everybody saying, where are you going? Oh, we'll never make this. We'll never be a team and things. And then, the Celtic end empty, and it was awful. But the wheel turned, and 1967 was 1967.
Now, David, can you give us just an insight into all these books you've written? There has to be, obviously, tell us about your latest books and where we can purchase them. And also, do you have a favourite?
Difficult. Right. Now, how can I put this? Yes. I've some books are easier written than others. I've said before that what I really like is doing biographies of old players like Sonny Jim and Jimmy Delaney and Tommy McAnally and people like that, you know. And my favourite player I would have to say in the old days would be Patsy Gallagher, largely because I got Patsy Gallagher from my father. You know, I would come home and say, Murdoch had a great game today, and Chalmers has a great game, and Jimmy Johnson, you know. And my father would look at me almost pityingly, and he would say, you never saw Patsy Gallagher. You know, so from that reason, I've inherited a love for Patsy. And he was one of my earliest books, actually, the biography of Patsy Gallagher, The Mighty Atom. But I think my favourite player would have to be Jimmy Quinn. I don't know why I like Jimmy Quinn, but I just do. I mean, he was he was twice sent off against Rangers, and both times a feeling of injustice about it. I mean, obviously I wasn't there, I can't say, but certainly the Celtic supporters at the time felt that he was very unjustly treated. So for that reason, you know, in fact, Jimmy Quinn was a man who, you know, was just an ordinary, humble, minor man from Croy who didn't actually speak very much to people. He was just a quiet, shy, introverted sort of character, you know. And yet he was the man who absolutely changed Edwardian society. Everybody talked about Jimmy Quinn. The story went that I think it was May 1910 when Edward VII died, and somebody heard somebody saying, "I see the great man's away." You know, meaning Edward VII, whereas somebody thought it was Jimmy Quinn, and his story started that Jimmy had died, you know, because he was certainly a greater man than Edward VII ever was. But I like Jimmy Quinn. I've always been lucky in that when I've done books, I've always had maximum support from the families. The Quinns, his granddaughters, they were very helpful. And particularly when I did the book on Jimmy Delaney. Jimmy Delaney's son was very, very helpful, and I went to Cleland and I met John Delaney there, and also John Kennedy, who of course is now in the Celtic backroom staff. He was very helpful, and it was just a great experience to do all my research and find out about all these great men. Currently, what I've done, I told you in lockdown, I did about the Scottish Cup, which should be around on the 2nd of November, I think. We've also, along with the Celtic Star, we've done one about Brother Walfred and the Bold Boys, which I did a third of that one. I did the early players. Somebody else did the Celtic's first season. Someone else did the Founding Fathers, which incidentally I found very, very interesting because it wasn't anything I knew very much about. And I did the early players, people like Dan Doyle, Sandy McMahon. Oh, now there was another one that Sandy McMahon's family, they were very, very helpful with what I wanted to do about Sandy. He was a great man as well. But it's been a great life. It's been a great time researching all these chaps. It's been my, you know, all-consuming hobby, perhaps. I don't regret a single minute that I spent on it. It's part of my identity, and I just love doing it, and I hope to keep doing it for many, many years yet.
Yeah, Liam Kelly, who's a young author, he's wrote for that book as well. And I think it's brilliant that someone so young is coming through now and has a passion for the history of the club.
Yes.
And Liam's going to start writing for us as well. He's just had stuff in the latest fanzine, and we're just delighted to get someone so young that has got a passion for the history, because most younger fans you speak to, it's just all about today.
Yes, indeed. And so much that of Celtic is actually bound up in their history, you know. And I think this is one of the reasons why I miss not being able to go to Celtic Park these days, because, you know, you want to walk among history, as it were, you know, and you don't get the opportunity when I went to Alec McNair's gravestone the other day in Larbert Cemetery, which I eventually tracked down, and it was just a great feeling to be in the presence of a great Celt. And even the silly things like trying to imagine the Davies funeral, you know, because Jimmy McGrory and Melee and McMenemy and all them would have been there. You know, just I imagine it, it's part of the history of our great club.
It is indeed. And part of that history as well was not doing the 10. Can you remember, you know, when we done the 9 in a row and then we were going for the 10? Because I've asked so many people this and no one can put the finger on it. You know, what went wrong that season?
I think that they just got a wee bit tired of success. I think the appetite for success was no longer there in the way that it should have been. We're talking here about season 1974 to 1975. Now, it's strange to say that because they won the League Cup very well that year by beating Hibs, if I remember rightly, and they won the Scottish Cup by beating Airdrie. So it wasn't a barren season, but it was just that the games that they should have won, they didn't. I remember in particular one horrible game in January 1975, when we lost to Motherwell at Celtic Park. And it was at that point that I became a wee bit disillusioned with the side. And I thought, you know, there's not really the go about them that I feel that there should be. It was also a day that really upset me because it was a day when some Celtic fans, and I emphasise some in the jungle, turned on Paul Wilson. And a few racist chants were heard at Paul because of the colour of his skin. And there was no excuse for that, nor could there ever be. I mean, I will not accept ignorance as an excuse for that sort of behaviour because Celtic fans should never, ever behave like that. Never, ever.
Hail, hail, David.
I was just that game at... I think we'd lost the Rangers at the New Year as well. And January was a bad time. And that particular game at Motherwell, I just wondered, you know, are we going to... And then we lost the Hibs at Easter Road about a month later. We beat them in the Cup that year, but lost them in the league, I think. I just felt, you know, the appetite just wasn't quite there. And I began to think that maybe we do need a change at the top, which, of course, is absolute blasphemy as far as Jock Stein was concerned. I just thought we could have done with a wee bit more go about us, more ginger about us, you know, more salt, as it were. I mean, the players were probably good enough, but they just needed a wee bit of more go about. It's hard to explain. And the support as well, I've never actually believed that Celtic fans are necessarily the best in the world because they do turn on their team sometimes when things aren't going well or there's a wee bit of apathy about them. And the gates went down that year, 1974 to 1975, just as if they'd had too much success. And I worry sometimes about whether this might get repeated. You know, we mustn't get to the stage where we feel that we're, you know, that the success doesn't mean anything because any League Cup, any Scottish Cup is absolutely important. And I can guarantee that as long as I'm alive, I shall write about it someday.
Absolutely brilliant. It's been brilliant chatting to you, Dave, as it always is. It seems like an age since we sat in Malone's and you chatted. But on that day, you surprised us when you broke into some poetry and you gave us a verse or two. So could we finish with a wee poem today?
Right. I shall tell you my favourite one, which is about a chap called Andy McAtee, the time of the First World War. What was the poem I did in Malone's Bar? I can't remember.
I can't remember myself. I think it might have been, maybe something about the Coronation Cup or around that time.
Oh, yes. There's a good song about that one. But no, my favourite bit of poetry about Andy McAtee, who came from Croy. He was a friend of Jimmy Quinn. And, of course, in the 1911 Scottish Cup final, there were three men from Croy playing in that final. There was Andy McAtee, Tommy McAteer, and, of course, the great Jimmy Quinn. But anyway, my favourite poem about Andy McAtee, who was a right-winger, billiard table legs, it was a great shot, great player. And the poem I liked was First World War, obviously. The Kaiser, they say, only once saw him play and said to his friends, "Dearie me, my German artillery's just fit for the pillory. They can't shoot like young McAtee."
Brilliant. Brilliant, David. Always entertaining. Listen, you look after that dog and make sure he gets a good walk today.
Well, my wife has since appeared, and she has taken him out the back door. So that's amazing. He's had a walk already this morning. He'll get another one in the afternoon because it's a fine day here in Kirkcaldy.
Brilliant. Listen, as I said, it was a pleasure to speak. I'm sure the listeners will love it. You brought the house down in Malone's, and I'm sure the listeners are going to love this. Best of luck with the books. I'm looking forward to reading them, and I'm looking forward to reading many more.
Okay, I shall keep going as long as there's breath in my body. I can assure you that.
And okay. if I can get a little promotion in for the fanzine, can I always read David in more than 90 minutes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Thank you so much, David.
Okay, then. Okay, Andrew, right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye, pal.
Bye.
Wow. David has wrote over 40 books, 30 on Celtic. The man is a walking encyclopedia, and it was such a pleasure to have him on the podcast and have him contributing to the website and our fanzine over many years. Folks, thanks very much for everyone who has bought issue 110 of More Than 90 Minutes. We still have a small amount of the print copies available. You can click onto the website and you can also download the digital copy. Or alternatively, you can take a quarterly or yearly subscription and we get that off to you in the post every month. With no ground or match day sales, your support is so much appreciated to keep the print copy alive. Once again, I have to thank my producer, Ron McQuillan, for putting up with me. Folks, if you like what we're doing and you would like to support us, you can do so by visiting our website, CelticFanzine.com, where you can become a member, subscribe, buy or donate for the price of a pint. Thanks for all the support so far, and thanks for listening. Don't forget, folks, you can download our new app. It's free, and you'll have access to all the podcasts, articles, daily news, video content, info on upcoming events, the fanzine and our online shop, all at the touch of a button on your phone or tablet. All episodes of the podcast are now available on all platforms, including YouTube. So hit the subscribe button or follow and you will never miss an episode. We are still working on something for the YouTube channel, Celtic Fanzine TV, and we hope to have that with you after the international break. Thanks again to our episode sponsor, Tip McCann, of the Tunnel Craftworks in Portadown. Much appreciated, Tip. And as always, folks, if your business or Celtic Supporters Club would like to sponsor the podcast or help us out in any way, please email us at info@celticfanzine.com. You can also contact us through the website or message us on social media. Keep all your comments coming in. Let us know what guests you would like us to have. And if you have a story to tell or your supporters club is having an event or a fundraiser, let us know and we'll give it a shout out. We will be back on Tuesday at episode 33 when another guest will be opening up their Celtic soul to us. We can also have a look back at the St. Johnson game and the Europa League draw. We were drawn in Group H with Sparta Prague, AC Milan and Lille. Tough enough draws, but the players will be looking forward to it. And so will we, even though we may be watching on TV. Enjoy the weekend, folks. Celtic kick-off against St. Johnstone at noon on Sunday. Away days will be on Sky Sports. It was great to see Celtic added the away game in Sarajevo to the virtual season ticket on Thursday. Now the conversation starts on who, what and where the Europa League games will be shown, which TV channels and how much it's going to cost us. So, folks, stay tuned, stay safe and keep the faith.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.